What Jupiter would also say, it says, if you can't find a mentor, find a tin can. A client of mine who was a filmmaker for National Geographic made this wonderful film on animals at play. And she captured a lot. And of course, watching animals play is just incredibly heartening. We love it. And it's also why we probably love to see humans, you know, around water, because it really brings out the best side of them. Look at these little humans playing well. So what she captured on film was animals playing, which was great, but also this extraordinary thing. There was a colony of monkeys, very hierarchical. And one of the monkeys was like the last to eat, the most disrespected, just caught all the flack, until that disrespected monkey found a tin can. And she captured all this over several weeks on film. So the monkey, just off on his own, you know, exiled from the community, got this tin can. He found it in the dirt, and he began to play on it and create rhythms. And then he began to roll it uphill while playing rhythms on it, and downhill while playing rhythms on it. The rest of the monkey community was like, wow. I mean, they were really impressed, and then they made him their leader. So we had a complete nonviolent revolution through play, theater, and art, and music, and drumming. You know, hey, if monkeys can do it, we can learn from them. You know, and again, this idea of life's cooperation in generosity. We want to learn from animals and animal-humans cooperation. We want to be radical traditionalists who take from the best of all cultures. You know, wonderful story that the Bushmen tell. This is a story that Lawrence Vanderpost tells. And the Bushmen have a very harsh life in Africa. It's very dry, so honey is a great thing. There's a bird called the honey diviner that when it finds honey nest in the ground, it will sing this beautiful song, you know, I found honey. The Bushmen will hear that and follow to where the bird is. And then a third important teammate shows up, which is the badger. And the badger will waddle on top of the honey nest and fart. And all the bees leave, you know, and then... And then the Bushman, the honey diviner, and the badger share the honey. Now, this is a business model. Surely we either are or know a badger, you know, and someone with a good voice and somebody good at finding honey. You know, I mean, again, you can extrapolate these things. And it's, again, crucial about telling ourselves the story that, you know, when the abuses of Darwin's survival of the fittest came to us as a kind of teaching, or the misinterpretation, it was thought of as justifying some of the more ruthless aspects of capitalism. But at the same time, there were wonderful naturalists who had a very different viewpoint that they were gleaning from nature. You know, Kropotkin in Russia, his book Mutual Aid, said that when you really study nature, what you see in evolution is cooperation, not competition. You see these wonderful synthesis. So again, we learn from this, and the theater of the marvelous and the cooperative all around us. So again, Jupiter invites us to participate in the generous circulation of life's abundance and this idea of circulation of wealth. Everywhere it's important. A friend of mine who's an inner-city activist goes to communities, and his first question to inner-city communities under duress is, what is your wealth? And they go, wow, what a weird question. You know, most people say, what are our problems? And they go, yeah, who knows how to do what? You know, who knows how to hammer something? Who knows how to... And then he talks about the journey of $1. $1 in a wealthy, established Jewish community will go around 8 times, at least, in its circulation before it leaves that community. In an inner-city community, $1 goes around 80 cents before it's gone, you know, through liquor stores and lotteries and stadiums and all that kind of stuff. Jupiter also says our definition of wealth has not to do necessarily with more wealth, but containers with which to circulate the wealth in our communities. You know, and Jupiter's there happy to educate us about how we create containers so that the wealth in a community circulates a lot before it leaves. It circulates sufficiently for everyone in that community to have a wealthy life. And Jupiter says, again, opening ourselves to this understanding really helps. Jupiter also says that gratitude invokes gratitude. Abundance invokes abundance. You know, poet Rumi says, your depression is caused by your inability to praise. A man who is depressed is a thief and steals from God every moment. So Jupiter says, you know, again, praise, gratitude, and enthusiasm are Jupiter's sacraments. You know, if one's really depressed, give something away. And certainly the Native American tradition in our country knows about this, the giveaway. And, of course, the turkey is the bird that symbolizes generosity and giveaway. And Thursday is Jupiter's day. So it begins to make Thanksgiving really look sort of, you know, the turkey, the sacred to the Native Americans, is the bird of generosity, and Thursday is Jupiter's day. It's an authentic ritual and interesting. Now, the shadow, all gods have their shadow. the shadow of Jupiter is excess. You know, unchecked Jupiter in all of us is the gorge theory of pleasure. You know, the whole cake over the sink kind of thing. So Jupiter would invite us to really examine what is real pleasure. A truly hedonistic culture would be happier, wiser, and savor each piece of cake, you know, rather than the whole cake over the sink. So if Saturn's construct was, I used to do this, difficult, negative thing, but now I do such and such. I used to be depressed and overwhelmed by all the things I had to do, but now I gather sufficient force and grace from everything in my environment. You know, from the tail wag of the dog, I grab libido, so that everything, you know, is an energetic gift and all my responsibilities are joyful. You know. Okay, whereas Saturn would have us do that, Jupiter's counterpart is really the art form of the blessing. When this, then that. You know, and it's for another person. When your boat is sinking in rough waters, then may the moon spin a silver pathway upon which you may safely tread to shore. You know, the art form of blessing really wants to make a comeback, and it is the construct, you know, when this, then may that. You know, when you are most discouraged, and we want to give this to our friends, you know, when you are most discouraged, then may the sun shine brightly. To begin to experiment in this kind of act of generosity really opens the whole thing for us. So Jupiter would also just say, you know, for us to be seated right now with open hands, palm up, and just imagine Jupiter's color. It's like breathing in deep shades of royal violet. Just, Jupiter really loves that, you know, and exhaling all constraint. Just, so full of violet enthusiasm, you know, it's just, you know, inhaling, you know, acceptance and generosity and joy, deep shades of royal violet, exhaling all constriction. So full of violet enthusiasm, Jupiter says, nothing can stop us now. And we're ready for the journey of on into Mars. Mars is the power of fierce compassion. The Greek god Mars, the Greek god of war, never killed anyone. Actually, it's sort of an ancient tabloid headline. You know, Mars never killed anyone. But it's an important thing to remember. He did kill one person. He killed the rapist of his daughter, for which he was acquitted by the Athenian court. So Mars doesn't have a rap sheet, basically. So the god of war, you know, is not convicted of an offense. And that's important, too. Mars really has been this fiery, erotic quality which does not want to be harnessed to the unimaginative confines of war and violence. So Mars is the power of fierce compassion. And Mars is a part of us, the heroic part of us, that really wants fresh expression. And for us, again, through our games and through our theater and through our, you know, invitation to young people, to invite all of us into a heroic quest. There is plenty to be done. And war is a huge, aside from atrocity, it's a huge distraction. You know, it says we have bridges that need building, we have trees that need replanting, we have water systems that need to be implemented. There are plenty of heroic tasks to be done. Anything that passes through this act four of history that can still grow fair or bear fruit and flower again, this is what we are stewards for. So Mars is the god of desire, eros, feistiness, aggression, heat, and action. We draw upon Mars for courage, dynamism, passion, and kinship with life. Conscious kinship is made manifest through active participation in heroic endeavor. So when adventure calls, you know, Mars says, woof. And Mars reminds us that spiritual life is not some safe, passive, wimpy trust fund excursion. It's a bold, active, heroic, and completely engaged adventure. You know, and we'd say that the Mars cult has been, you know, almost too numerous in human culture to list. But it says Mars is the heroic questing impulse to protect self and others. Out of this desire to protect grew the ancient warrior cults, which were so widespread. At the very least, these cults included Celtic, Greek, Slavic, Roman, Teutonic, Nordic people, as well as most of the populations of India, Persia, and China. They all worshipped Mars as their predominant deity between 1800 BC and AD 1000. Now, it's also interesting, too, the border between myth and history gets very, very thin. It was some years back that scientists found the graves of the Amazons, these Amazonian women, who were worshippers of Mars. And indeed, they were found with ritual objects, iron daggers. Iron is sacred to Mars. They had 40 iron-tipped arrows in their quivers. And almost all these women in these graves died of illness or old age. They had wounds, but they did not die of their wounds. So it tells us also that Mars was not aggression for the sake of aggression. It was to protect the community and to protect the grazing lands and all of that. And we know also, certainly, that the positive warrior cult of the Celts is the hero king who only made war in the service of protecting the community, the exemplar of which, of course, is King Arthur. And the mission of the fellowship of the Round Table was nothing less than the salvation of the world through the diminution of violence. There's a rumor that King Arthur did not die, but went to Avalon to sleep, you know, and to be available to the world's call when needed. So we might also say that the King Arthur part of all of ourselves, we want to summon that noble Mars. And what that noble Mars does, it again weds itself to Jupiter and the whole nature of theater, that the stories that are told about heroism are so crucial. You know, and Ursula Le Guin and a lot of wonderful modern devotees of mythology say, you know, where are the important stories now about poor little boys and girls who allied with the foxes, using nothing more than cunning and animal allies, you know, overcame, you know, tyranny and violence through cleverness and wit and compassion and deftness? These are all at the heart of most folk legend traditions, and they want to come back up through us. Also, love affair between Mars and Venus that, you know, in almost all mythologies, one of the stories that's told is in the Orishas, Mars is kind of chango, this bravado, bluffing. But Mars by itself, of course, can get a little too high-handed. But whenever Oshun, who is like Venus, walks into the room, Mars has a big crown on, he always has to bow to her. He can't help himself because she's so charming, and he bows and his crown falls off. So it's always, again, the love affair between Mars and Venus. You know, how does Mars become the protector of the community? It is through the love affair of Venus, through the cultivation of art. In Cuba, I saw these wonderful dances called Congo dances, in which the dancer takes the rage of the community, just, again, the rage, and cooks it into the wealth of the community. And in her own womb, we talk about the circulation of wealth, in her womb she contains the wealth of the community, cooks the rage into outrage, cooks it into available energy, and just, it's a very powerful dance. And again, it takes something difficult and transforms it into available Mars energy for everybody through the art of Venus. So this is crucial. It's also, you know, we can see things in pop culture in an otherwise not tremendously interesting movie called The Neverending Story. There's a moment where there's the wonderful little boy hero, and there's an evil empress, I'll call her Zendara, you know, and she's tricked the little boy out of two of his three magic wishes. Now, in fairy tales, of course, the unwise use of wishes is a consistent theme, and that's also part of Jupiter's shadow trick. Jupiter says, you know, I will give you infinite opportunities, half of which are really good for you, and half of which are toxic mimics, you know, illusory seductions. And you have to use your intuition and your wisdom to feel out which is which, you know, to avoid the gorge theory of pleasure and to do what really is your individual path, going, well, here's conventional success, but real wealth feels like it's this way. So in this movie, the little boy has been foolishly given up two of his wishes, and he only has one wish left with which to save the world. And so what he does is, you know, in a moment of crisis, he goes, oh, I wish for you to have a heart, Zendara. She goes, oh, I can't do evil and destroy the world anymore. Now, this is what Mars wants, this kind of ingenuity. And again, it's that idea of what would we wish our enemies? We wish for them to have a heart. In the radio show that I do, I've had a lot of, you know, environmental activists and Earth First people on, and because the show is a welcoming kind of Jupiter bowl of eccentric magic practice and social effectiveness, many people surprise themselves by telling their secrets, you know. And so the Earth First people, who like to be kind of like thought of as kind of swaggery and, you know, not too new age and everything, but they had these wonderful practices which were great. They say that to save trees, what they do is they yarn them. They put colored yarn all the way up the tree. And this does a number of things. One is chainsaws cannot cut through yarn. And so loggers have to do this unmacho thing of putting down the chainsaw and pulling out little teeny scissors and go snip, 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 which is a big non-macho thing to do. But what they also do, and this is again something that we can all take adaptations of, this idea of ritual and effectiveness, is as they yarn the trees, they weave their prayer into them. And they say, whoever cuts this, may their heart be opened, so that they feel compassion for all of life and kinship, and they cannot do something which is harmful to the whole community. This idea of fierce, strong magic, intention put into things that are willing allies, is clean as long as we are laying out something and invoking something. The gods want us to do that. As long as it is always with the proviso, let it be best for everyone involved, and it is something that one would welcome in one's own life. One cautionary tale for Mars is that, you know, Mars in this language is called the ruler of Aries and the ruler of Scorpio. Aries is that kind of, you know, springtime wolf, you know, emerge through frozen crust of earth, you know, feisty, make things happen. Mars, as the ruler of Scorpio, Scorpio is fall, you know, late October to late November. It's introversion intensity. It's the more hidden, dark, nighttime intrigue Mars. And so we need to honor Mars in both its manifestations, or one will get out of whack. If we do not honor the dark Mars, the intrigue Mars, the Mars that has a passion for positive intrigue and needs darkness, and then is hormonally kinned with creation, then we only have Mars in Aries, which is the hyper-yang adolescent, you know, feisty Mars, but way yanged out. So it's incumbent upon us to begin to experiment with this. Power comes through one rather than from one. In the Arthurian legends, I mean, the Arthurian legends are full of this teaching, but the Arthurian knight Balin refuses to return the fairy sword that holds power beyond his control. The sword gives him superhuman strength, but each heroic act he performs with it is coupled with disaster. So it's a wonderful part of the Arthurian legends. Again, Balin will not return this magic sword, and he assumes all the credit for its potency. So, you know, his willful belief that he is the source of the power inevitably leads him to kill the man he most loves in the world, his brother. He destroys his brother, himself, the world, and he is the creator of the wasteland. So what we say is the hero or heroine, part of us, who mistakes heroic powers for their own, is doomed to wander alone in the void and to destroy that which they love most. And this is the shadow of the cowboy, you know, in our nation, and his ethos of rugged individualism and progress. You know, the unrelated male part of all of us, whether we're men or women, the unrelated male who creates a literal wasteland of gum wrappers, overgrazing, annihilated indigenous people, and heartbroken women in the wake of his linear drive west. You know, so a healing antithesis is really to be found in the South African word muti, which means power and medicine. Power is meant to be healing, and Mars' heroic power is meant to be healing for the whole community. Part of what also amplified this, I have a wonderful colleague, Wendy Ashley, who is a great keeper of astrological star lore, and she periodically takes on apprentice students. And one of her students was a Vietnam vet who was still working it and really bitter and angry, and he went to men's groups and said, nah, this isn't doing it for me, these are just circle jerks, you know, what can I do? So he then discovered really on his own that he would organize Vietnam vets to return back to Vietnam and to rebuild the temples they'd bombed. So again, this idea that the hero then becomes the healer. And this is taught to us also in Qigong and in Chinese medicine, in which we know that the healing and killing points in the body are the same points. The difference is intention. The Mars warrior is the healer. You know, and again, that's also what we want to offer those stories and invite also those parts of ourselves that all cultures, prior to our own industrial culture, would pay particular homage, honor, and attention to its Mars, to the adolescent surging of testosterone and hormones through the young men and women, through vets who had gone out to protect the community. You know, and they would say, you know, come, well, you are welcomed, you are honored, you know, we need you to help build the infrastructure, we need you to contribute to this grand thing. You know, we have this, our Mars, and again, sort of wanted to harness it to video games and war and all those kinds of things. So we really want to offer it more options. So Mars says, you know, anger without action is merely tantrum yoga. You know, it's what Swami Vyanananda calls tantrum yoga, where you use your anger to heat your home in winter. But, you know, or where you, you know, hold your breath until God gives you what you want. But Mars says rather, you know, initiate, get fired up, breathe fiery red. Imagine breathing fiery red, you know, into your whole body now, just, you know, and summon fierce energy by thinking with me. You know, I'm willing to take on the next stage of my heroic quest, whatever it may be. You know, and so Mars says, great, okay, go make something happen. You know, go find the grail. And it leads us on to Venus. Venus is the redemptive power of beauty. We enter Venus's realm that Mars leads us to. Matthew Arnold said that to be cultured is to be acquainted with the highest possibilities of the human spirit throughout time. And this is Venus's domain. Again, if we look up culture in a good dictionary so that we know what we're talking about, Its first meaning in the OED is worship, reverential homage. And then the second, third, fourth, fifth meanings are soil, land, plants, crops, and bacteria, culturing them. And then only by analogy, way down at the bottom of the list, is human culture as though it were a biological process. So Venus always asks us, do we live in an economy or a culture? You know, and Venus reminds us that the opposite of aesthetic is anesthetic, that we either we have a living sense of beauty or we're anesthetized, you know, which is why beauty has been exiled from our world as trivial. You know, but Venus says, no, she wants back in, absolutely. And it's crucial, because Venus says there's no solution to anything in our personal or collective lives without beauty. There's no solution to crime in the inner cities until gardens happen there. You know, Venus might also say, hey, who stole my tomato? But Venus says, experiment with creating beauty, you know, everywhere. So one of the great Venus stories comes to us also from Dame Ragnall, because we are also at a historical moment where we wonder, you know, what are lovers supposed to do with each other? What is the relationship of the land and the humans? You know, what is the relationship of men and women meant to be? And we can go back to mythology, which wants to surface and gain fresh expression through us, for a lot of wisdom waiting to be there. And one of my favorite stories is the story of Dame Ragnall. So the story basically is this. King Arthur is hunting in the woods, and he wounds a deer, and so he unstraps his weapons and crawls into the brush to find it, whereupon an old enemy finds him and says, ah, Arthur, you know, I really hate you, and now I'm going to kill you. Arthur says, I'm unarmed. That would be, you know, unfair and unchivalrous. His enemy says, that's true. Okay, here's the deal. I'm going to give you a year to answer the following question. And if you can answer it truthfully and truly, then you may live. But if you cannot answer it, then I will cut your head off. And Arthur says, that sounds great. What's the question? And his enemy says, the question is, what do women want? And Arthur goes, oh, man, I'm screwed now. You know, So Arthur spends the year, you know, going out, sending out messengers, you know, getting all these answers, which are, you know, amusing and deep and tragic, but clearly inadequate. And the time is approaching, you know, for his appointment with his enemy. Whereupon, Dame Ragnall rides into town, and she is described as the most hideous hag that anyone has ever seen. She has huge tusks, and her breath smells like the beach at low tide. She is really, really, truly funky. And she rides up and she says, Arthur, I know your circumstance and I have the answer you need. You go, oh, thank you, that's very kind of you. He goes, no, no, not so fast. I will give you the answer that will save your life. But in return, I will marry the handsomest man in court, your nephew, Sir Gawain. And Arthur goes, oh, you know, I don't know. And Gawain says, truly, uncle, you know, that's fine. And maybe she doesn't have the right answer either. So the deal is struck. So the old enemy arrives and Arthur runs through, you know, his great voluminous bag of answers. And the guy goes, no, 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 sharpens his sword. So finally, Arthur pulls out the answer that Dame Ragnall has given him. He says, okay, what women most want in the world is sovereignty. And his enemy goes, ah, curses, you know, and leaves. So Guinevere, of course, thought that a small wedding would be nice, but Dame Ragnall was having none of it and insisted on a huge feast and banquet. And, you know, all of Gawain's lovers, who were numerous, because that's a lot of what he was up to, were like, oh, poor Gawain, you know. And there was Dame Ragnall, the bride, tearing and devouring entire, you know, wildebeests and tearing at things with her tusks and flesh. And so finally, the wedding couple retires for the night, you know, to the wailing of Gawain's previous lovers. And they're in bed. And Gawain is like this. And Dame Ragnall says, hey, sweetie, how about a little kiss? And so Gawain summons all of his chivalry and kindness. And he says, as he begins to turn to her, nay, I will do more than kiss. And he turns and he sees that she is the most beautiful woman he's ever seen in his life. And she says, oh, you have half relieved me from this terrible curse under which I was afflicted. And here's the deal now. The deal is now I can be beautiful half of the time, either with you in court during the day, you know, and ugly at night, or beautiful with you at night and ugly during the day. What do you choose? And Gawain goes, oh my God, you know, on the one hand, you know, social appearances, and on the other hand, you know, career moves, you know, on the other hand, you know, different things, you know, hey, you know. So finally he says, it's too big. I can't decide. You decide. And she says, ah, you have entirely released me. And I will be beautiful all the time. And they made love, you know, it's a beautiful phrase in the story. It says they made love, you know, time out of time, you know, for days. And of course the court was like, oh, what happened to Gawain, my God? Now, what is sovereignty? There is innumerable wonderful scholarship about this story. Ananda Kumaraswamy wrote about it and said that part of it is about also how the king or the human community, the kind of Venus in its Libran rulership, must always be wedded to Venus in its Taurus manifestation. That the human community must always wed the land, even in its most foul-breathed, funky qualities. Sappho said, you know, if you are squeamish, do not stir the rubble on the beach, you know, nor make love to women, you know, if you're squeamish. So part of it is the necessary wedding of the human community to, you know, the funky, beautiful part of nature, and to give her sovereignty, you know, in that sense, in this lovemaking process of culture to the natural world. And then also Jungian analysts often will say, well, it's also about men and women, you know, it's about how, you know, men all know that when they're in love with a woman, there's this hag element, you know, the woman goes, you're not really going to wear that, are you? You know, and he has to kiss the hag and love her anyway. So there are lots of ways to think of it, but one way also Venus would invite us into a kind of historical astronomical understanding of that. All pre-industrial cultures would really watch Venus. It's a very easy planetary cycle to watch. And basically what it is that Venus will be the morning star for about 260 days, which is human gestational cycle. And then Venus will disappear for some period, 2 weeks to 40 days, and then reappear as the evening star for approximately 260 days, and then disappear for 40 days. It's called Venus's descent to the underworld, and then reappear as the morning star. It's part of Venus's cycle. Now again, very important to all pre-industrial cultures. In Mesoamerica, Venus is a Quetzalcoatl, it's a masculine figure. But most cultures were really timed to Venus, because not only, again, 260-day cycle is human gestation, they noticed a kinship to this planet, and it is very visible. One thing also was, I was always suspicious about, well, why is Friday the 13th supposed to be unlucky? You know, and when you look at it and research, the real research, well, Friday is Freya's day. It's Venus's day, sacred to Venus. And 13 is sacred to the goddess in pre-Christian culture, 13 lunar months to a year. The tradition was when Friday and 13 coincided, you were supposed to stay home and make love all day as an homage to the goddess. Let's bring that one back. and, you know, 13th floors too, you know, the whole thing. So also, you know, Venus would say to honor, feed, and further work with Venus. You know, her mudra would be really any graceful dance. You know, so as the music plays in a moment, a wonderful invocation of Venus, just imagine filling yourself with Venus's color, which is deep emerald green. You know, and we return to the primal garden. You know, it says, you know, eat an apple, give a dinner party, serve ribs, you know, do the whole thing. But imagine this kind of emerald green as Jackie McMillan and Amakela guide us on a Venus reverie. So Venus then leads us to Mercury, the art form of communication. And so Mercury is the part of us that really is the magician. And there's a wonderful book by Robert Farris Thompson called Flash of the Spirit. It's about African traditions and African American art and the magic of invoking. So he says working with mercury means that one must cultivate the art of recognizing significant communications, knowing what is truth and what is falsehood, or else the lessons of the crossroads, the point where doors open or close, where persons have to make decisions that may forever affect their lives, will be lost. So mercury is the part of us that presides over the power of speech as invocative. And just the physical fact, astronomers consider the planet Mercury to be elusive, mysterious, and fast. It moves at 24 miles per second through its 88-day orbital circle, so it's really winging around there. Owing to its proximity to the sun, it's visible to us only 32 to 44 of those days and can only be seen close to the sun before dawn or dusk. You know, dawn and dusk are transitional times. Hence, the mysterious and elusive god Mercury presides over all times and all places of transition, all crossroads, and again, in traditional cultures, crossroads that we come upon, decision points are Mercury's domain. There's a temple to Ramses II at Abu Simbel in Egypt, and it's designed in such a way that only the inner sanctum is illuminated only at the equinoxes. And what it illuminates is there sit statues of three gods fully revealed by the dawn of the equinoctial sun. And there's a fourth god to the left, only partly illumined in shadows. And this is Ptah, the name giver. And it's one of the many aspects of the force of intelligence we call Mercury. So it says during such times it's especially important around the equinoxes to intimately consult with this god, this Mercury part of us. So Mercury is the god of mind, intellect, the power of language and voice. You know, and also, you know, analogous to the planet Mercury's proximity to the sun, the god Mercury is so close to us that he is invisible, so central that he cannot be seen closely, the purloined letter of the spirit world. So it says, our magical capacity to manifest through language, both thought and uttered, is so central to us that we often take it for granted and spend time and energy seeking more power. You know, instead, we simply need to learn to use the power with which we are already endowed and which is constantly replenished as it flows through us in acts of attention. You know, we think of the magician tarot cards. Again, that focused act of attention, one arm up, one arm down. It says when we pay attention, we draw upon forces of alert intelligence. You know, so the evocative power also of words, the language, alphabets are sacred, our potent evocative power of chants. The word mantra means mind tool in Sanskrit. The medieval philosopher Nicholas of Cusa said, if we understood the real name of even one thing, we would understand the mind of God. And it's also just that idea that women who are pregnant and giving birth, one thought in many traditions is that the child tries to send its name, you know, Maggie, and we hear it imperfectly, oh, Margaret, you know, which is again why people go, the name's close, but not quite right, you know, and again, this idea of listening. So Mercury is very much the magical, invocative power of voice, language, and craft to summon actual reality. So it's this crucial concept. It's also Mercury, the legends of Mercury are all about the telepathic universe. Mercury is kind of an aspect of Uranus, the trickster god, that says we're always in communication, whether we know it or not. There was a wonderful story in the New York Times about an experiment done by scientists in Geneva, Switzerland. And it was one in which two twin photons were separated and sent to opposite ends of the city via optical fibers, where they were given a random choice to turn right or left. Both paths were equally available to the photons. When the scientists stimulated one photon to turn right, even though there was no physical way for the two of them to communicate with each other, the other photon turned in the same direction. So Mercury asks, what is communication and how does it occur? You know, what is this telepathic quality? So an apparently more joyful and certainly less contrived example of distant communication is the mating practice of blue whales. I don't know if anybody is familiar with the mating practice of blue whales, but what happens is after considerable kind of nuzzling and creative foreplay and really getting to know each other as another whale, you know, what happens is they simultaneously turn away and they swim miles and miles apart, and then they've been observed at the same exact moment. They cannot see each other, and apparently they cannot hear each other. They both turn towards each other, and they swim faster and faster and faster and faster, and as they meet, they kind of enter each other and erupt above the surface, you know, in this kind of joyful, erotic union, and apparently that was so much fun that they keep doing it again and again. They go, oh, let's do that, and they swim far away. So we'd say, you know, this should make those poor twin photons a little jealous. It's a lot more fun. So they have a good date. Mercury says if we have a relationship in which we're in good communication, distance should be no impediment. We don't need a phone. You know, our dance with each other can be as beautifully choreographed as blue whales mating or ice skating partners at opposite ends of the rink, you know, let alone twin photons in different neighborhoods in Geneva. So Mercury also says, you know, there's a little footnote. People who know a little bit about astrology, you know, enough to be superstitiously involved, you know, we'll go, oh, Mercury retrograde, no, you know. And just to sort of clear up the record on this, or you know, how can we dance with it in a better way? You know, how can we dance like the blue whales more? That retrograde motion, just physically what it means is it is when from the Earth's perspective a planet appears to be moving backwards. Now, the Earth is actually passing its orbit, but it appears to us to be moving backwards. And Mercury, because it's so fast, appears to move backwards for some weeks about 3 or 4 times a year. And the one traditional astrology thing is that, you know, oh, you know, don't sign contracts on when Mercury is retrograde. One or both parties will change their mind, or machineries that facilitate communication tend to break down. And it does seem to be true, but this is not the point of it. We'd say that retrograde motion invites us to do any activity that begins with RE, reflect, reconnect, recover, reverie, renovate, you know, all of those things, and that if we lived in a truly reflective culture, we would welcome these times of non-forward push. Again, it's part of recovering our own Mercury that says Mercury, in order to be communicatively appropriate, needs to withdraw every now and then, and to, you know, it looks like it's going back over space, you know, ground space already covered. So it says go back. There's something one missed the first time through. Go back and reflect upon decisions. And we're meant to have these time outs from industrialism. So Mercury would say, just to, again, align with this power we have of invocativeness, you know, how do we feed this God? And Mercury would say, well, we breathe in cool light, and we breathe out hot, heavy, dark. You know, just breathe in cool light, breathe out hot, heavy, dark. It's a way of gathering our wits. But we also imagine now Mercury's favorite color is yellow, to breathe in and infuse our bodies with brilliant yellow, and exhale golden yellow, bestowing kind of ashe, the power to make things manifest through words, on others. So it's like inhaling golden yellow, exhaling golden yellow as a blessing of ashe on others. And Amakela and Jackie will also now bestow upon us a wonderful Mercury chant that is about the healing of crazy minds. Is that a fair way to put it? This is a traditional chant that will allow us to gather our wits to be cool-brained, effective magicians, and to alleviate ourselves of modern industrial stress. Mercury leads us to the moon. Now, and the moon is really the power of memory to create the future. So we'd say all cultures have had a moon goddess, you know, from the Babylonians Ishtar to the Egyptians Isis, Mayan Ixchel to the Polynesian Hina. Rulers in Eritrea and in the Tutsi tribe were once called moon. The Gaelic people derived their name from Gaelic, their word for moon. Britain used to be known as Albion after the milk-white moon goddess. Libya is the name of an Arab moon goddess. In Vudun, she answers to Madame Lalune. Now, it's interesting. Scientists have also recently posed the question, without the moon, what would happen to the Earth? There would be virtually no tides. The sun causes some minor tides. Or predictable seasons. The 23.5 degree tilt of the Earth's axis would vary chaotically due to the gravitational pull of the sun and Jupiter, the two most gravitationally potent bodies in our solar system. So the moon stabilizes the Earth's orbital tilt. creating the rhythm of seasons and thus allowing for conditions that nurture life. And surfing, you know. So it's interesting to think that the moon, okay, which is always associated with feelings and moods, is this literally stabilizing force. You know, this planet would have no seasons if it did not have a moon. It's a very interesting scientific fact to think about. And then to say, that makes even more sense also that in all cultures the moon is the protectress of life. All pre-industrial cultures, again, would measure the evolution of a civilization by what did that culture nourish and cultivate. It's like in the I Ching. The I Ching says, you know, if you really want to know somebody, watch on what and on whom they bestow their care. Similarly, if you really want to know what a culture is, watch what it moons, what it nourishes. So the model is that living in our emotional inner life is this understanding that a culture is as evolved as what it protects. And that again, in pre-industrial cultures, what seems to be, you know, everywhere, is that a culture would protect its children, its environment, its elders, you know, and its whole kind of relationship to animal world. So by that measure, you know, we live in an insane modern world, because not only are those things which traditionally have been treasured, honored, protected, you know, not only are they not protected, but they're actually like slungshot out into vulnerability. You know, and again, we'd say that the interrelatedness of all things says that that lives in our private emotional lives. You know, how we treat the earth, the word mater, which means mother, comes from the same root word that we get matter from. How we treat the earth is how we treat the feminine, is what we experience in our bedrooms. The moon, again, this watery, emotional, quicksilver quality, says the emotional reality, we share it. Our emotional inner lives we think of as private are not really at all. So to address the modern world's priorities, this particular goddess part of all of us invites us to follow her moonlit path to the archetypal world. Now the moon says, slow down, future ahead. Things are so important that we really want to pace ourselves in this biological time sense. It needs that kind of time out. The moon and Venus, these feminine parts of ourselves, say beauty is always available to the reflective and unhurried mind. That's what we need to restore ourselves and to gain access to allies. In an interesting series of novels, Doris Lessing posits that the Earth is cultivated by three extraterrestrial cultures. And one is Shamat. And Shamat feeds on discord and kind of the ugly hum of the nuclear power plant. And then the next group of people are the Syrians. And they're sort of like a cosmic world bankers. You know, they come, they make experiments, they screw up, thousands die, they move on. You know, they don't care too much, but they're not mean, they're just amoral. And then there's the Canopians, who are thought of as the wise advisors. And some of her novels deal with the education of bureaucrats into wisdom. And the Canopians are asked, how do you operate when you arrive on a planet in trouble? And they say, we have no rules. We simply feel what's needed and respond appropriately. So the moon says, you know, there is no ideology so useful that it can encompass life. You know, life is just much more varied, like tendrils coming up and around and out of concrete surfaces. So to feed our moon, you know, is to feed our capacity to respond appropriately without thought. What needs doing? Whether it's, you know, this, you know, vase of flowers feels much better there, or this is what this person needs right now. So the moon in us also really invites us to draw upon strength larger than ourselves and reveals also how to work with our inner emotional lives in ways that are potent and connect us, meaning. We'd say that the moon in an astrological chart will reveal someone's spiritual tradition. And the story goes something like this. That the moon by placement, we'd speak to it and we'd say, all of us in different flavors, there's a part of us whose tradition reaches way back into the past. And this is a tradition of lunar priest, lunar priestess, people who really knew about the interrelatedness of all of life. You know, and in different flavors, all of us have a different access to this tradition. So the moon in the chart, or the moon in us, would say, well, that's a wonderful thing, these lunar priests and lunar priestesses, kin and responsive to life, behaving and dancing appropriately, what is needed. What happened to this wonderful tradition is it journeys from mythic ancient world into modern world. Well, the moon says, well, look each one of us at our mothers, our biological mothers, as a microcosm of what happened to that tradition as we move into the modern world. And it's a way of also seeing our mothers as spiritual colleagues, many of whom might have been blooming, many of whom might have been neurotic. because it's also a journey of what happens to spiritual insight and potency in the modern world. So if we think of how power becomes neurotic, we think in the ancient cosmology, you know, power was meant to be a stewardship. It would flow through us and out into the community. But as we come into the modern world, and let's say our mothers did not feel fully welcome, or they didn't have the emotional freedom to think of themselves as positive witches or lunar priestesses, then power becomes neurotic in the sense that if one feels powerless, you know, and it's sort of backed in, then one attempts to control the immediate 10 square feet around one. And then in this kind of spiritual lineage way in which we're invited to think of our emotional lives, along comes each one of us, born into the particular unique family circumstance. And it's as though mother, not consciously, but energetically, says to each one of us as children, here I bequeath to you, my child, my moods. I don't know what to do with them. Here, you work it out. You know, your father and I don't really know what men and women are supposed to do. Here, you work it out. And here I also bequeath to you this ancient tradition, you know, which has become neurotic and twisted in the modern world. Here, you translate this function of lunar priest or lunar priestess back into the modern world. We don't have those functions, so you have to create a front or a cover whereby to be that and whereby to recover your capacity to respond appropriately to circumstance. So this says also, you know, it's like Carl Jung wrote to a colleague of his with a very strong kind of moon chart placement and said, your moods are messengers from some deep and ancient part of yourself. But thinking about your mood and even feeling your mood will do nothing. The only way the mood can deliver its message is if you give the mood its expression. If you sing the mood, dance the mood, write the mood, paint the mood, make an altar to the mood, but it must be physical. You must incarnate the mood. It's like the foot to the floor, the pen to the paper, paintbrush to the canvas. And in doing that, the mood, you might say it's a message from your deep interior self or your tradition, whatever metaphor is more comfortable, or both. But in doing that, what happens, it's a wonderful experiment. You go, oh, you know, terrible mood. You express it, you look up and you say, mood's gone. Ooh, but look at what it left. I know what to do now. And in Vipassana meditation, all moods are viewed as fabulous fuel and positive, you know, even moods we wish we didn't have. You know, and their way, again, is also of linking it completely to the body. Say one had a difficult mood, you would then notice, where is your hand and what is it doing? Where's the tension in the jaw and what is it doing? All the physical incarnational attributes of this mood. And they say that once you do this, something very interesting happens. It's once you connect the mood to the body, you surf the mood to the edge of the universe where it explodes into radiant available energy. So moods are thought of as not to be suppressed. And this is where even, you know, kind of feminists have been snookered by the reality police. Oh, a bad mood. I will function in spite of this mood. You know, I will keep going. And, you know, all of us can do that, you know. And the mood says, that's called dissing the moon. You know, the mood says, that's very disrespectful. There are no irrelevant moods. There are unworked with moods. But the mood always wants its expression and always has something valuable to communicate. It's, you know, it's really visionary activist principle number 6 that says, you know, we only possess the power of an insight when we give it expression. So the moon would like to give us that. You know, an extreme example also is Samuel Butler, fun 19th century writer, you know, said that whenever he got stuck in writing, he merely had to remember how much he really hated his father, and he was re-inspired again to finish The Way of All Flesh. So it can be a bad mood, it can be a good mood, it can be a hate-your-father mood, but it will express itself in creativity. So the moon then says, you know, go forth and do thou likewise. The moon is called the intelligence of interrelatedness. And in occult tradition, it's thought of as residing in the occipital, the kind of moon-curved shape of our heads. It's said that the occipital region of our brain is connected to every point in time and space. And in a useful experiment also, it is said that to have a strong image, an image in one's brain is composed of molecules as much as this table. And the stronger the image, the more its tendency to manifest, just like Jupiter taught us. You know, stories will attract the molecules of their manifestation. And so an experiment, something to entertain as a possibility, is that images enter the world, say many teachings, through the occipital region of the brain. And so something to experiment with before we all go to sleep, you know, tonight perhaps, is to have a strong image and to actually imagine it backwards. We usually see it in back of our eyes, but to move it out through the moon region of the brain, you know, which is the occipital region, and out into the world. And says that's an interesting thing to experiment with and see how much faster one is at manifesting. So the moon also would say, you know, the moon is that part of us that is infinitely also loving and nurturing, and says biological mother might have been useful, might have not been useful, but was really only a stand-in for larger moon nurturing. And so the moon also would invite us right now to imagine receiving support from above and below and from east and west, you know, north and south. You imagine support coming in, so that we can all be safe enough to take the interesting creative risks and feel safe. You know, and then in reciprocity, again, combining all of these gods, Jupiter comes along and says, you know, when we feel safe, we reciprocate, we send out an act of blessing. You know, and as we exhale, we might just imagine then sending love and blessing out to all creatures above, all creatures below, all creatures in the east, the west, the north, and the south. So the moon says, you are the moon to them. How do we radiate love and support without depletion? And this is part of what the moon would tell us. You know, in these meditations that are taught in many cultures, you know, about receiving energy and then sending out blessing, it says if there's the slightest bit of draining or effort in one's blessing, that isn't it. It's receiving and sending, receiving and sending. It's a continual circuit. How do we give in a way that is not depleting? Again, it's that circuit. And part of what this traditional chant that we're about to do also for the moon, it's Kai Kai Kai, Yamaya Alodo. And it's to Yamaya, who is part moon ocean goddess. You can join in on the easy part, Kai Kai Kai. Kai 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 means how wonderful, how wonderful. And the words go, how wonderful, how wonderful. Mother's house is in the ocean. My mother is an anchor in the storm. So Yamaya is a part of all of us that we tap into through this music and through these words that will keep us safe, especially in times of flux, that we may be maximally generous. At the central sun, okay, the sun, the core of our solar plexus, and representing and stimulating and catalyzing the kind of core of our individuality. So the sun is called, you know, really the confluence of allies. And we might just do this very, very serious, important chant, which is, hail to the sun god, he is a fun god, ra, ra, ra. So why don't you join me in this incredibly important chant? Hail to the sun god, he is a fun god, ra, ra, ra. That's great. Okay, the sun is very amused, and the sun likes that. There's a wonderful thing also called the pattern on the trestle board, and it just starts off by saying, all the power that ever was or will be is here now. And again, science says everything that we see around us is a manifestation of solar light transmuted through plants. You know, vitality and creativity represented by the sun are always present and always available, constantly assuming new forms. You know, creation and recreation of the sun's visible mystery. And the sun's power is especially potent, it's said, at times of seasonal transition, which all known cultures have celebrated, William Blake reminds us that eternity is in love with the productions of time. So during seasonal festivals, the power of eternity pours into the specific moments, quickening the tide of animism. So however we want to, by ourselves, individually, or in groups, begin to reinvent meaningful ways of celebrating these gates of power, the equinox and solstice points, which cultures have celebrated for 25,000 years, the sun really invites us to do that, and in so doing begin to create a global mythology and ritual and way of invoking power larger than ourselves and offering ourselves to a larger sense of guidance. The sun speaks to each aspect of our personality, awakening its loving and magical potency. One way to think about that is, again, sun signs. As the sun passes through each sign of the zodiac, it awakens the presiding god force. So when spring begins, Aries is ruled by Mars. Mars comes alive. So anybody born as an Aries is an incarnation of Mars, an incarnation of the heroic. Then people born in Taurus, are incarnations of Venus, beauty in its sense of sensual kinship and devotion to pleasure. Geminis, Sun and Gemini, are incarnations of Mercury, trickster communicative gods, the power of the invocation. Cancers are incarnations of the Moon, the Maya. Leo's incarnations of solar, radiance, joy, theater, reminding us, the Leo part of all of us reminds us that, create theater or live melodrama. We contain the entire zodiac. Virgos, again, are incarnations of Mercury in its refined, articulate, measuring, ritualistic orientation. Librans are, again, the second incarnation of Venus in the sort of social aspect. Scorpios are incarnations of Mars in their intrigue aspect, with Pluto as a tour guide. And we'd say Sagittarians are incarnations of Jupiter, the jovial god of research and exploration and theater and storytelling. Capricorns are incarnations of Saturn, the cool guy. Aquarius are incarnations of Saturn, again, with Uranus as its tour guide. And Pisces people are incarnations of Jupiter, second rulership, the exploration, but this time with Neptune as its tour guide, the interior, deep delving sea realms. So the sun calls to the Mars part of us, for there is much heroic action needed that only each one of us can do. And the sun now calls to the Venus part of us, for there is much to be loved and created that can only be created by each one of us. The sun calls to the Mercury part of us, for there are many ideas to be exchanged now. And the sun calls to the Moon part of us, for there is much to be protected and much to be cared for. The sun calls to the Jupiter part of us, for there are many heartening stories to be told and new theatrical venues that want to be created now in the modern world. And the sun calls to the Saturn part of us, for there's much work to do in building the structure of a sustainable future. And the Uranus part of us, for there are many ingenious solutions that each one of us is a possessor of that the whole team needs. And the sun calls to the Neptune part of us for as much that only each one of us can envision as we co-create a new culture. And the sun calls to the Pluto part of us, for there's much to be transformed as we become social change artists and public alchemists. And the sun would just also like to add this theme, the path of love as an antidote to bitterness. So certainly the sun can cast a harsh shadow. If we do not have a profusion of gods from whom to draw sustenance and to whom we are in turn devoted, then the sun beats down upon us in harsh and simplistic certainty, searing the necessary and cooling mists of complexity and mystery. And we all know that cruelty and bitterness are natural responses to being treated badly. But the sun part of all of us, when we feed it, challenges us to rekindle the loving heart of generosity for those who've truly earned the right to be bitter and yet have refused the cup of poison. Like St. Patrick, they were given a poisoned cup and they raised it to the light, blew off the poison, became heroes. And it's part of all of us. Blessed and toast to all of creation, even those who would have poisoned them. So it's easy to become bitter, and it's easy to whine. We all know that whining, in a sense, is a first world privilege. If you're really up against it, you're not whining. You're going, no, just trying to survive, But one of the things in my journey to South Africa that was very powerful is meeting people who had every reason to be bitter, and they were, and that was understandable, but meeting those extraordinary people who had every reason to be bitter and who were not. And Krena Alkuk is a white South African woman who, through a lifetime of devotion and also betrayal and hardship on the African veld, had really earned the right to be bitter. And although she'd teetered on the edge of responding in violence back to the violence done to her, she had not succumbed. So many people had asked her, you know, a journalist had asked her, you know, how have you not become bitter? And she replied, she said, the path of love is not the path of comfort. It means going forward into the unknown with no guarantees of safety, even though you're afraid. Trusting is dangerous, but without trust there is no hope for love, and love is all we ever have to hold against the dark. Love is worth nothing until it has been tested by its own defeat and its own betrayal. Potent stuff. So the sun also says, you know, the fifth flower is depicted in the sun card in tarot. And it reminds us that the four flowers are the four kingdoms of evolutionary form: mineral, vegetable, animal, and human, all of which originate from solar energy. The fifth flower in tarot cards and in this card is the next evolutionary step of consciously reverent humanity, you know, which we undertake now together with the help of the gods who work for us so that we may work for them. And say, let us imagine the fifth world, the fifth flower blooming that we're a part of. And so the planets would really like to thank you for doing this noble good work. And we remember Mercury's gift of Ashe, which means the power to make manifest. So in gratitude for the work that we've all done together, the planetary gods would like to offer this last invocative gift. So as they say something, think of it as bubbling forth of that part of you. And if you like it and are willing for it to be true, then just say Ashe. So Pluto sizzles, you know, I'm willing to be cooked, you know, and transformed in the alchemical furnace of life, realizing that I am an undercover agent for positive change in the world. Ashe! And Neptune sings, through my vivid and infinitely creative imagination, I am constantly co-creating with the divine the myriad forms of life's possibilities. I am dreaming the universe into being. Ashe! And Uranus invokes, I welcome the enlivening zap of revelatory change that changes the circle of habit into a spiral of life. You know, blast me into the place where I can do the most good. Ashe! And Saturn intones, I am aligned with the power of focus, concentration, realizing that freedom lies on the other side of responsibility. I will go to the movies after I finish the project. Ashe. And Jupiter encourages, I am filled with the abundant enthusiasm of life force. Open my path before me and grant me the opportunity to be of maximum good in the world. Ashe. And Mars exhorts, I am filled with spirited, bold, courageous, energetic bravado and desire, which inspire me to dance passionately with life. Ashe. And Venus croons, I am attracting all the love, beauty, and creative inspiration for my full, ecstatic blooming. Ashe. And Mercury proclaims, I am the witty, clear, articulate brilliance of life, which expresses itself through me and grants me the capacity to say the truth with a kind heart. Ashe. The moon reassures us that I am safe enough to take the interesting risks in life. Ashe. And the sun cheers us on by saying, I am always fully, radiantly myself, whether I know it or not. I embrace the divine experiment of my own uniqueness, remembering that the world needs my gift. Ashe. Let us dream a more loving world into being. Vital images will save the culture, and we are the storytellers. Ashe. Thank you all for doing this good work. Thank you. And thank you to Jackie McMillan and Michaela. Thank you.